Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubenstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, we're diving into the awe-inspiring world of high-altitude adventure. Our subject is a man whose name is synonymous with daring expeditions and summit triumphs, the legendary climber and adventurer Kenton Cool. With 17 successful ascents of the mighty Mount Everest to his name, along with many other mountain peaks around the globe, including the seven summits, the highest mountains on each of the seven traditional continents, Kenton, you could say, is not just cool by name, but by nature. You'll have heard him mentioned on previous podcast episodes with Sir Ranulph Fiennes and Ben Fogle. Kenton has accompanied them on some of their most challenging ascents. Ben Fogle summited Everest with Kenton, and Kenton led Sir Ranulph Fiennes up the north face of the Eiger and to the summit of Mount Everest too. His adventure-filled life began in the UK, but he quickly found his heart in the Himalayas. He brings to life some of his most incredible adventures today and the valuable lessons he learned along the way. So, let's hear from him now. Kenton Cool, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. It is amazing to see you today. How are you? How's your day been so far?
Yeah, it's been good. It's a Monday morning. I love Mondays. They're full of opportunity, not just for the day, but for the week. And I'm normally pretty pumped on a Monday morning. And let me just give you an example. So this morning, I am now sat with you, which is super exciting, but I've already had an hour-long meeting. I've been for my run. I've walked a dog. I've done school drop-off. And I've cleaned up some of the gym area outside. So Monday mornings are my most productive. I drop off after lunchtime. Mondays so far, so good. It can go downhill with this though.
Have you been traveling much this summer? Have you been have you been away? Can you tell us a bit about what you've been up to?
I have been around the UK on a lecture tour. Then I bounced almost immediately to Alaska. Wow. And I did like a mini excursion to Alaska.
What was that like?
Oh, it is wonderful. I mean, please don't judge me. I do a lot of corporate speaking and I'm on various speaking circuits. And Alaska was, I was on a cruise speaking. Cruising is perhaps not my thing. Mm-hmm. However, mm-hmm. I totally see why people want to do it. It goes up, I think it's called the Incise Passage in Alaska. So the ship goes from Vancouver all the way up to the Hubbard Glacier. And you see loads of wildlife. And I know that cruising and those big cruise ships have an environmental impact that's certainly not lost on me. At the same time, it's quite an incredible experience.
Yeah, because that is a part of the world that is so hard to really like to see and cover a lot of ground. So many remote parts. So what are the kind of things that you saw on that journey?
Well, I mean, when you go up the Hubbard Glacier, and I forget what the second one is called, there is no way of accessing those inlets or fjords, if you want to call them that, unless you are going by boat or seaplane. I mean, even the capital of Alaska, I didn't know this. I just assumed the capital of Alaska was Anchorage, which I've been to a number of times on my way to climb Denali. But it's actually Juneau. And Juneau, you can't access by road. You have to go by boat or fly there. I don't know who came up with that idea for a capital city that you can't get to by road. And small towns like Ketchikan, Skagway, they are sort of frontier towns. I mean, Skagway, I think it's Skagway, was part of the Great Gold Rush, and the town boomed during that period of time. Mm. Really interesting part of the world to visit. I mean, if you want to be, if you want to be sort of pedantic about it, you drop into some of these towns, and most people don't go more than, I think it's 800 yards away from the ship. So, you've got to be actively wanting to seek out what the local community has on offer and things like that. You've got to get away from the immediate vicinity of where these ships berth. And there is a negative impact as well as a positive impact. I mean, Juneau, I was chatting to a couple of the local people in Juneau, and they were saying at the height of the season, they might get 7 or 8 of these, and they are big cruise ships coming in. Juneau will have 1.2, 1.3 million tourists a season coming in via the cruise ships.
For a small town, that's a lot.
Yeah, that has an impact. And you know, what I wanted to know was, well, do those tourists have tourist spend? In which case, there's a positive there. And they do to an extent, but a lot of the, and I'm not necessarily saying Cunard do this, but a lot of the cruise companies own a lot of the businesses in the 800 meters that people would walk to. So the money's not necessarily going to the local community. So if you do go on a cruise, you know, take the time to, you know, book your sightseeing tours with local outfits, not necessarily through the cruise ship. You know, take your time to get away from that 800 yards or mile radius from the berth and go and see, you know, some of these towns for what they really are and spend your hard-earned cash in those areas, because that's going to have more of a positive impact on the community that you're going to visit.
That's really, really good advice. Noted. Yeah. Right, Kenton, today we are going to go on a journey through the 7 chapters of your life's travel diaries. Some real highs, I imagine, and potentially some lows as well.
I was looking through these the other day. It's like memory lane. It's quite cool.
Well, we're going to start at the very beginning. Chapter 1 is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would you pick for that?
So I was thinking about this, and it made me chuckle. I mean, we didn't really have very much money when we were growing up. My father was unemployed for a lot of my childhood, but we used to go to stay on a farm in West Wales, just outside Cardigan, every single year for the first 2 weeks of August. This was our summer holidays. We occasionally used to go down there in the autumn half term as well. And every holiday for my first 18 years was exactly this. And it was great. This is going to crop up a couple of times in these 7 chapters. But my earliest memory, we had a silver Toyota Corolla estate car, which we loaded to the gunwales. I mean, it was just above. I mean, I'm sure the exhaust pipe was almost touching the ground. And we used to travel from where I lived to West Wales. And I remember, I don't know how old I was, but it's very early in the morning, which we used to do the drive early in the morning. And we're like 3 miles from home. And I think Dad went over, I don't think it was a speed hump, but something happened. And all 4 hubcaps of the car span off at the same time and came shooting past the car. And I just remember my father probably swearing or something like that. And he jumped out. And he was trying to find the hubcaps at about 4:30 in the morning in people's gardens. So he's rummaging through these gardens. And I just remember being sat in the back of the car with my sister. Because my father was this great guy that, you know, grey areas, you know, he didn't break the law, but there's lots of grey areas in our lives growing up. Mm-hmm. And yeah, rummaging around people's gardens, trying to find these damn hubcaps to put back on the car. I think he found 1 out of 4. But that's one of my earliest memories. You know, more than the holiday itself, more than sort of leaving early in the morning. We used to have a bacon sandwich before we left, and we used to stop at the service station by the Severn Bridge to split the journey up. And the other thing that we used to do is we used to have this big clock in the kitchen, and we used to, as a family of 4 of us, used to try to guess what time the clock would run, because you had to wind it up. You know, what time the clock would run out. So we each chose a time. But losing those hubcaps, that's probably one of my earliest travel memories. I mean, I don't think cars even have hubcaps anymore, do they?
No. That part of Wales, that comes up, that's such a quintessentially British summer holiday. What was it like? Yeah. You know, is it a place that is somewhere you'd go back to now for a holiday?
Oh, 100%. I mean, we have been back a little bit further south as a family. Well, this leads on to our chapter 2 in a way.
Okay.
Because the place that I fell in love with, you know, it is West Wales. And we can come on to that in a moment. But this area that we're talking about, you know, I went with a family relatively recently, slightly further south in Pembrokeshire as opposed to Cardiganshire. I've climbed a lot on that southern Pembroke coast. So from Tenby all the way around to the inlet with Haverford West, that's fantastic. Some of the best sea cliff climbing in the world. Really? It's absolutely unreal. Steep limestone cliffs, sea crashing underneath you, seals popping up to have a look to see what's going on. And it's actually where I proposed as well. Wow. I proposed to my wife.
So it really is a special place.
Yeah, super special. I don't visit it enough these days, maybe because I spent most of my childhood holidays there, if not all of them. So I do go further afield these days, but it's somewhere very close to my heart, for sure.
Interesting what you say about the climbing. Are there some routes that are accessible for, you know, a more like entry-level climber?
Absolutely. I mean, the sea cliffs, limestone traditionally is quite steep rock, so you do need to be of a certain standard. But Pembroke, there's so many miles of cliff line there. Certain areas are very well suited to the beginner. If anybody's thinking about going there, now, I would highly recommend getting a local climbing guide. He or she can show you around. They will have all the ropes, all the harnesses, all the equipment. Because the thing with sea cliff climbing, the access can be difficult. You know, you've got to know what the tides are doing. Mm-hmm. But also sort of sea breezes can make the rock almost unclimbable. You get this strange, almost grease-like substance that sublimates on the limestone cliffs, making it, total misery. So local knowledge, like almost everywhere that you go, local knowledge is invaluable. And tapping into that knowledge is, will raise anybody's experience by a factor of 10 or 100. It really would. Now, book yourself a day-long, afternoon-long climbing course. I highly recommend it.
Mm. And I mean, when you were there as a child, were you climbing? Was it an adventurous outdoor childhood?
Oh, it was always adventurous. It was very adventurous childhood. I didn't start climbing until I was 17, 18. But we certainly walk up the Pisili Hills. The Pisili Hills are, as I say, it's a range of mountains. The name gives it away, the Pisili Hills. But for me as a youngster, these were quite adventurous places. And the Pisilis is actually where the rocks from Stonehenge came from.
Really?
The Blue Mountains. And the mind boggles how, I don't know how old Stonehenge is, but I mean, we all know it's super, super old. I mean, how on earth they got those huge lumps of rock from the Pisilis all the way to Salisbury Plain. I mean,
astonishing.
I just can't imagine it. But no, it was always, we spent a lot of time outside. We used to go down to the beaches. There's some fantastic beaches in West Wales. And occasionally you do get the blue sky days, which is worth going to the beach, which is lovely. And a lot of walking. And I remember a lot of eating sardine sandwiches inside a misted up car as it was peeing down with rain. So you do get a mixture of everything there.
Yeah. And so you mentioned for chapter two, the first place you fell in love with, Wales has a big part to play there.
Oh, it's got a huge part. And you have to remember, I was born in Slough. And I was hardly likely to fall in love with Slough. Apologies if anybody loves Slough.
like John Betjeman, come friendly bombs and fall on Slough.
Yeah, come fall on Slough. So I was sat down and I was going through this the other day. And I think one of the reasons why West Wales is so close to my heart is partly it is beautiful. But more than that, it was when the family came together. So there was obviously mum, dad, and I've got a younger sister. And it was time, dad had a standard 9-to-5 job when he was working. Mum used to work, she did some shift work in a local supermarket and then worked in local greengrocers. And both parents were heavily involved with the Scouts, which I was involved with. So we were actually a very busy family. But those 2 weeks in Wales was downtime, and you didn't have the mobile phone back then. So when you were on holiday, you were truly on a holiday. And I just remember these hugely romantic times, or I look back on it with a romanticism. And we were there all together, and we used to do these very family orientated things. I remember my parents used to peel the labels off the wine bottles and stick them on the there's like a glass partition in the little cottage that we used to rent, and we used to put the wine labels up on there, and they were left on there year after year. And we used to hide coins, because you used to have to put, I think it was 5p or 10p in an electricity meter for the electrics in the place. So we always used to leave a little stack of coins somewhere year on year. We used to shower outside with a hose pipe. And the cottage was right by a working farm, and there was, it was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Lloyd, and there was Bob Dog, who used to destroy all my footballs. And it was just this wonderful time of being young and carefree.
That sounds lovely. I love that.
Very nice.
And you mentioned that you didn't start climbing until you were in your late teens. This is the chapter about, falling in love. Was there a moment that you fell in love with climbing and you realized, right, I want this to be my career?
Well, no, the career came later, almost through a lack of inspiration for anything else. I'm wondering if you can read my notes, because you're segueing so beautifully into what's coming next. I can't believe you're doing this so well, because vying with, where did I first fall in love with, was Pakistan, which I suppose actually moves us on to chapter three in a way, which, forgive me, I didn't write down the chapter titles. Chapter three was
the place where you learned the most about yourself.
Exactly. So chapter three kind of links to what you've just said. So age 19, I think I was 19. I went to Pakistan, and it was a climbing expedition. So I started climbing about 17. Age 19, I put together an expedition to some unclimbed peaks in Pakistan, and we had a phenomenal time. Pakistan actually was vying West Wales for chapter two, the place that I fell in love, because I fell in love with the people of Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly more than just the people of Pakistan, the people of mountainous, or the people of the Himalayas. As a very naive boy that went to school in High Wycombe, grew up just outside Slough, and used to holiday in West Wales, going to Pakistan was a bit of an eye-opener, to say the least.
Yeah.
And we did everything on, as a student, we did everything on this huge budget. When I say huge budget, it wasn't a big budget. It was a tiny, tiny budget. And let me just explain that a little bit, because I spent 7 weeks in Pakistan in the first university holiday. Mm-hmm. And 7 weeks in Pakistan, including the flight, was just over £500. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, this was 1993, so it's a little while ago now. But it just shows that adventure and travel does not necessarily need to be eye-wateringly expensive. You can go to these amazing places and have life-changing experiences pretty much on a shoestring. In fact, doing things on a shoestring are often the way that you are going to engage most with the local community, or in my mind they are anyway. So we were doing everything to try to save cash. So, for instance, we didn't fly because we wanted to go to North Pakistan to go climbing. So we didn't fly to Islamabad, which would be the obvious choice and what I would do now. We flew to Karachi, which is in the south of the country. Mm-hmm. I think Sindh is now on the Foreign Office like red list, because it's like anarchy there. They hold up whole trains with rocket launchers and rob everybody and that sort of stuff. So we go there and then we buy, I think it was second-class tickets on the train, and we travelled right through Sindh on the train with all our kit and age 19. And it was super hot and super sweet. And I've just got this memory of the sun's just coming up, as it does in the Indian subcontinent, that area. Just that there is something special about sunrises and sunsets there. Maybe it's the dust, maybe it's the position on the planet, but I just remember being so deadly tired. We were on the train for 26 hours.
And landscape are you going through to get to this point?
You're going across the plains in the middle of nowhere, and it's as hot as hell. And, we've been through the night, and it is a sleeper, but there's six of us in a four-person, this is second class. And I just remember the chai waller running up and down, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning. We pulled into some station somewhere, and he's running up and down, and he's just screaming, chai, 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 chai. And he's got these super hot, sweet, super strong tea, and he's ladling it out, and the milk's forming that sort of scum on top. You get like a skin, and he serves it in these little metal mugs or cups, stainless steel cups that you burn your lips on. And it was just incredible. And I would always have that memory of this sunrise, and the six of us, all exhausted, covered in dust, dehydrated, hungry, thirsty, and the chai walla, just incredible.
Oh, wow, what a picture.
But that expedition, because we did everything wrong, yet we did everything right. You know, we got on a public bus. Once we got to Islamabad, we then had to drive up the Karakoram Highway. So that's a public bus. We didn't hire what we should have done. We hired our own private minibus. We got on the public bus, and it kept having punctures, and that took 29 hours, and I got really sick on it. Yeah, we didn't hire a cook for the expedition. We did all the cooking ourselves, and we bought all the food in Gilgit ourselves, and going around all the markets trying to work out how much rice you need to buy or how many chickpeas you need. Or I'm 19. I grew up at home. Mum did all the cooking. And then there's the expedition itself. And as I said, I fell in love with the Pakistani people. I fell in love with the food.
Well, the food that you got, not the food that you got from the market.
Not the food that we were cooking. No. But the food that you get in the hotels. And, we ate a lot of street food. I'm still a firm believer that, eating on the street is one of the best places to eat. It doesn't matter where you go. I'm big into street food. I think that's where you get the best flavors. That's where you can connect with the community.
Authentic taste.
Yeah, 100%.
Just backtracking a little bit, how did you go from being a climbing novice to suddenly being in Pakistan and attempting a first descent? Like, how does that work?
Ambition beyond my experience.
Really? It was just, it was kind of naivety and ambition, basically.
Yeah. At Leeds University, there was this amazing climbing community that was super, super energetic and enthusiastic. And you couldn't help get caught up in that. And this was pre-internet times. Well, the internet was just beginning to emerge, but this is pre-internet times. You couldn't look up things. So everybody had books. And the books at the time, my heroes were the likes of Doug Scott and Chris Bonington. And their name was synonymous with the Himalayas. And little naive Kenton is like, screw climbing on the little gritstone or limestone outcrops of Yorkshire. I want to go to the big mountains. I want to go to the Himalayas. And my ambition was way in excess of my experience. That said, we had a fantastic experience. We did some new routes. We went trekking over the DSI Plains, which is this beautiful part of Pakistan just south of Skardu. And for me, it was a life-changing. It really was. It was a life-changing expedition, and not necessarily for the climbing, but for everything else.
That's brilliant. And then what you didn't look back, it was from that you had the climbing bug and...
Yeah, 100%. I didn't make climbing my profession until I was about 30. So I spent 10 years just following my own ambition. And that's where I got a lot of my experience, which then segued really nicely into what I do now, which is a professional mountain guide.
Mm. And, speaking about learning about yourself now as a professional mountain guide, as I mentioned in my introduction, you've climbed Mount Everest, innumerable times, and you've described yourself in previous podcasts I've listened to and interviews as a very emotional guy. So how do you keep those emotions in check when you're in areas like the death zone on Mount Everest, for example?
Well, unfortunately, they always have a habit of spilling out at some stage. If you know how to control emotion and if you know how to manage it, it can actually be a bonus. It can be a positive thing. I think showing vulnerability is empowering rather than the opposite. And I think a lot of my my clients do appreciate that I wear my, you know, my thoughts and my emotions on my sleeve. You know, whether it be me jumping up and down sometimes, which I can do when things don't go quite our way, or whether it's, you know, the emotion of reaching a summit or the safe conclusion of an expedition. That said, if we use Summit Day on Everest as the example, I you know, one needs to be pinpoint focused. I use the term binary thinking a lot, and binary thinking is just focus in on what's really, really important. And we hear that a lot in the corporate world, you know, focus on what's in front of you and all these sorts of things. But, you know, it's certainly with, you know, you sat at your desk with emails and things coming in, you know, you could argue, well, you know, binary thinking doesn't really have, it's not that important. Whereas on Everest, it's super important. Mm. Even with supplementary oxygen, when you're in a death zone, you're starving your brain of O2. And the first thing that gets affected is your ability for rational thought, cognitive thinking. Mm. It gets inhibited by lack of oxygen.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. So binary thinking is, you know, there's five or six things that I'm concerned about. You know, how much oxygen we have, the time, the overhead conditions, underfoot conditions, mental, physical state of the client and the immediate Sherpa team, and where they are, you know, where they are on the mountain. That is it. And the other thing which I think is desperately important is to eradicate emotional thought process and replace it with logical thought process. And that's something which I've managed to teach myself over like 20 years or so being in the big mountains, because if emotional thought process gets in the way and if it influences decision-making in the death zone, you potentially are going to make a poor decision.
So can you give me an example of what you mean by that?
Well,
like what would be an emotional thought over a logical one?
So logic is what's happening in real time. It's hard information that's directly in front of you. So it is, you know, what the weather is, you know, what the immediate weather forecast is, how much oxygen we have left in the O2 tanks, you know, physical state of client. You know, that's real information right in front of you. That's hard, real-time intel.
Yeah.
Emotional behavior might be thinking about my daughter. Oh, is she having a good day at school? Oh, you know, those thoughts that can generate a chink in your armor. Because let's face it, on Summit or Day of Everest, your armor needs to be up and it needs to be best part of bulletproof.
Mm.
And if there are any chinks, then those chinks have a horrible way of getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. If your mind starts to wander, you know, back to jazz, you know, my beautiful wife, it's like Monday morning, you start thinking about school drop-off. Oh, God, and, you know, I'd love to be at school drop-off. You know, I adore doing school drop-off or pick-up or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, that's going to start tugging, but certainly at my heartstrings. And then am I going to make a right decision with that swirling about in the back of my brain? Yeah, because actually what that thought process is telling me is that I want to get home as quickly as possible. I want to be part of the school run. I want to be part of making breakfast for my son or my daughter. You know, I want to be out, hug and hold my wife. And I want to be with my friends. I don't want this hardship. I don't want this grind of going back up to Everest, putting one foot in front of the other in the pitch black, seeing a thunderstorm 200 miles away. You know, is that thunderstorm coming our way? You know, how's the client? I'm really cold. You know, conscious about the number of, you know, that's all alien. That's all well out of anybody's comfort zone. That's hard.
Mm-mm.
And on the other hand, home. That's really snuggly. That's comfortable. I just want to be there. Okay, guys, let's turn around. That's the danger of emotional thought process. And, you know, perhaps it's not the best example, but that shows you how it can erode the fortitude that you need to be able to get through hard things.
Yeah.
And we all
it's
experience
like the
hard
ultimate
things.
Mindfulness.
Yeah, exactly. And we all suffer from hardship and go through hard times. You don't need to be climbing Mount Everest. You could be on your morning run. you know, or whatever it is. You could be doing something at work that you don't like to do. Perhaps you've got to go and tell Sid down the corridor that his work's crap and he has to try harder, and that's going to be a really difficult conversation. I don't really want to do it. So, yeah, the logic in me is I should do that. The emotion in me is, oh, I really don't want to do it. It's going to be really hard. Okay, I won't do it. But, you know, I send an email. Mm-hmm. Because that'd be much, much easier. I can hide behind my email. But the logic is go and have that conversation. Mm-hmm. Just go and do it and get it done. Mm-hmm. And then life's going to be so much clearer afterwards. You know, and then if you look at the Everest one, you know, I just want to be at home where it's all snuggly and everything else. Okay, we're going to call and we're going to go home. You know, whether you like Lance Armstrong or not, I think he came up with the phrase of pain is temporary, but quitting is forever. And you get home mm-hmm. and you're twiddling your thumbs at home going, I don't think we made the right decision. Yeah. You know, I think the emotion got in the way on that one. And we should have summited.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Spencer Matthews was a guest on my podcast a couple of seasons back, and he was in part talking about his forthcoming documentary at the time, Finding Michael.
And
his experiences on Everest. And then I went and watched it, you know, when it came out, and I was surprised that, you know, when they were filming their attempts to find him, how many dead bodies were literally dotted over the mountain that they were like, oh no, that it's not him, that's not him, that's another one. I mean, that's not a normal part of life to kind of see bodies dotted up a mountain. Like, how do you process that as a kind of relatively regular part of your professional life?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways you can look at it. Is, you know, unfortunately death is part of all our lives. It's the only given that we have, and it surrounds us way more than we think it does. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've all lost loved ones. Death is an unfortunate part of life, and one of the reasons why life is so rich, because we never quite know when it's going to happen. I mean, I've seen my fair share of death in the big mountains, and not only have I lost family members, but yeah, I've lost a lot of friends in the big mountains. You never get dumb to it. The issue on Everest, one body. I saw one body. Right. And it's a body that's been there since 2019. Don, who's just underneath the head of his step. And you know it's there, so you can brief the client that we're going to come around the corner in a minute and there's going to be a body. It's going to be sat underneath the step with the oxygen mask still on and da-da-da-da-da.
That's a lot.
So, I mean, I don't quite know if the production company sort of hammed it up a little bit. There are bodies there, but you've actually got to go out your way to see them other than Don's. Don's, right. You've almost got to step past. And I think being briefed on it, knowing it's there, then you can summon the courage to do that. But it is dangerous. 23 people lost their lives on that mountain this year. So for whatever we read in the press about the queues and Everest is simply a walk. Well, yeah, it's not the most technical mountain in the world, but death still occurs, you know, up high. Death occurs on every mountain. How you prepare for it? I don't know. I mean, I've had people die in my arms. I pulled Sherpas off of fixed ropes. We've been hit by stones. And you can imagine the trauma that causes to one's head. I mean, really ugly, ugly scenes.
Has it ever made you want to stop climbing?
No, if anything, quite the opposite. And yeah, I've said this before, I think it's only when you really push to the edge of what we do and you stare into the abyss, you know, stare into the darkness, i.e. you push yourself so far that you are teetering on the here and the there, and you look into the darkness and you realize how illuminated life is and how rich life is and how life needs to be lived, you know, as much as you can, because it's only when you realize that it can be extinguished really, really quickly. And you know, I personally don't believe in the afterlife. I don't think we go to a beautiful place afterwards. I'm more logically based. And you know, I think once life is extinguished, we're not going to get a second go. But you've got to push yourself to that point to realize that life is fragile.
So it's almost a motivating factor.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
100%.
I mean, we've been talking about Everest. Chapter 4 is your all-time favorite destination, Kenton. I wondered, is it Everest? Where is it?
No, it's not Everest. No? I don't even have Nepal down here, but perhaps I should. I mean, Nepal is my second home, and I'm super fond of it. Maybe because I go there so often that it didn't necessarily come into my thought process, which is perhaps not quite as sexy or as glamorous to me as it really is. So I started big to start with. I mean, Pakistan, I love Pakistan. I've only been there 3 or 4 times. I love to go back more, explore more. And I think one of the reasons why I got Pakistan perhaps more than Nepal is because there was a greater sense of unknown to me. And Nepal's pretty geared up for the tourist. And I've got a great agent over there, Iswari Powdy, Himalayan Guides. And no matter where I am in the country, I could give him a ring. And no matter what it is, it will be sorted out for me. Which a lot of people go, wow, that's a great comfort tool to have. And it's fantastic. But I like the jeopardy that comes with travel. And Pakistan is full of it, in a good way. You get yourself into all these scenarios and you're like, oh my God, how did I get here? How am I going to get myself out of here? And I don't have such a good grasp on logistics and things.
So it's more of a challenge.
It's more of a challenge. And because of it, it's more of a challenge. I find it more rewarding. And because I know the country less, I've not traveled that extensively in Pakistan. Yes, I've gone north to south. I've spent a lot of time in the mountains, but you know, I really want to go to Peshawar, for instance, which is right on the Afghan border. Yeah, you know, I want to go further east in the Karakoram Mountains, you know, right up to the Indian border. I've only just scratched the surface. Nepal, I've been to a lot. I've also got Bhutan down here. You know, Bhutan's a country I've been to quite a few times now. I've traveled north, south, east, west. I've been to really remote villages. I've got beautiful friends there. And it is a unique country in the way that it's developed and it's developing. I mean, to use gross national happiness above GDP as an index of development, I find deeply, deeply interesting. I struggle with Western society. I mean, how can you have year on year growth? I mean, it's a fallacy. Yeah. Whereas, you know, GNH seems much more grounded, you know, rather than just looking at numbers.
And do you feel that kind of palpably when you, you know, are exploring the country? Do you feel the shift in perspective there, that, you know, that is what is prioritized?
Well, I think what you see or what you feel in Bhutan a lot is, you know, as soon as you get out of Thimphu and say Paro, you are in quite remote villages. Even Bumthang, which is one of the bigger towns in the center of the country, they're pretty remote. And all of a sudden, there's a much more community-minded society. And I think with that, it brings a certain joy to those within the community, because there's this thing called connection. I'm holding up my phone now, and you know, we feel that we're connected through the phone, but actually we're not. A connection is proper human interaction. And you know, if you go back, we don't need to go back that many generations. You know, we're tribal. We need that connection, and that loss of connection, I believe, so, and in my opinion, you know, makes us quite a relatively unhappy society, looking more at the individual rather than the community. And you know, GNH is built on 9 pillars, and you know, and one of those is the community, the importance of the community, and also the way that it interacts with the natural resource, the natural resources, you know, the way that they live in harmony. I'm also quite in awe that you can have a I'm going to get the name wrong now. I'm trying to think how the government works. It's a democratic monastic monarchy or something like that. So you've got the elected government, you've got the religious body, and you've got the monarchy as well. Mm-hmm. And because there's these three different parties, they keep one another in check all the time. So, I mean, unlike our political party here, which seems to have free rein to just, you know, excuse the language, screw anything up and pass bills that really, you know, make no sense to anybody, all of a sudden, you know, you've got these three bodies which self-check the whole time. And I'm not saying that Bhutan is without its issues. I mean, you could look back to K4, the fourth king, and, you know, and there was like ethnic cleansing and, you know, the deportation of a load of, you know, Nepalis and things like this. When I say ethnic cleansing, I don't mean there's genocide, but they were deported. They got rid of a load of Nepali ancestored Bhutanese. So it's not without its own issues, like any other country. However, I think there's a lot we can learn in the West from Bhutan. So I've definitely got Bhutan down here. But then I thought, well, maybe I need to look, instead of from 40,000 feet, maybe I should look from 5,000 feet down. And I've also got Colorado in the US.
I love Colorado too.
I mean, it's the sunshine, the skiing, the climbing, the mountain biking. I mean, it's got it all. And fantastic access with Denver Airport, you know, like half United. And I've also got, you know, and then from 5,000 feet, I came down to 1,000 feet, and it's a place I've only just scratched the surface. And believe me, I know it's not a true representation of the country, but I've got Cape Town. I went to Cape Town for the first time last year. Oh, my goodness. What an amazing city. If you're into the outdoors, it's got it all.
Yeah.
And it's got great food. It's relatively cheap to the European travelers. I know it's getting more expensive. I mean, some people say, well, it's not a safe city. Every time I've been there, I felt safe. It's got great biking. It's got great coastline. It's got great surfing. It's got great rock climbing. It's got great paragliding. It's just
ticks
insane.
All the boxes.
And the weather. Oh my goodness, the weather's amazing. So
Those amazing all-time favourites. I absolutely love your choices.
I was struggling to pin it down to one, I'm afraid.
No, I love a smorgasbord like that. And I would say that all of them are just so interesting in their own right. Bhutan is a really interesting one because it's certainly been like, so I'm not a climber, so I wouldn't be choosing a destination based off of that. But even so, I would think that for me, Bhutan, the kind of spirituality of it, the beauty of it, as you say, the people, the diversity of the landscape, I certainly one that's very, very appealing. All of them are, but that one is one that is, I think, a bucket destination for sure.
Bhutan's incredible. You can't help but, I mean, I'm not particularly religious. You probably picked up on that, but I do believe in a spirituality. I do perhaps believe in a higher being, not necessarily the godlike figure that a lot of us would worship. But you go to these places, even like Pakistan, you know, winning the mountains. But Bhutan especially so. Mm. You step off the plane. In fact, I think Bhutan's the only international airport I've ever been where people are walking down the steps and there's always a queue to get off the plane because as soon as somebody steps out the door onto the steps, they stop and they start looking around.
Wow.
Because it's incredible.
Because it's just so beautiful.
It's beautiful and the clean air and it's and then the walk across the tarmac to get to the terminal and everybody's stopping to take photographs and looking around. It's just off the charts. I mean, how many people do that at Heathrow? How many do that in Frankfurt? I mean, you don't even do it in Cape Town, and Cape Town is one of my like top destinations. It's got everything. It's got history. It's got a fantastic trekking. I mean, the food's, but you know, it's interesting food. I love spicy food, and food there is quite spicy. It's got culture. It's fab. It's beautiful. Can't recommend it enough.
And you've made a career out of discovering hidden gems, essentially. I mean, Chapter 5, your hidden gem, a place that you love that my listeners might not have been to or might not know very much about. I mean, I would imagine that you have a huge amount of places that you might be able to pick for this one.
Yeah, so this, but this might be, I gave this a lot of thought. And I don't know if it's a hidden gem or an overlooked gem. The European Alps in summer. Now, a lot of us perhaps go to the Alps in winter to go skiing. Mm-hmm, a lot of us probably fly over the Alps to go to Greece or maybe Turkey or somewhere like that for our summer holidays. But the European Alps, especially in summer, I think are unparalleled with the opportunity to do whatever it is that you as an individual or family want to do. So let me just clarify this. Generally, the weather is off the charts good. Blue skies, high pressure, great temperatures. This year, okay, it's a bit El Scaccio, sitting in like 40 plus degrees, but that's a little bit unusual. It's super lush. It's really green. It looks beautiful. In terms of adventurous sports, there's mountain biking, via ferrata, there's trekking. You know, the food is generally fantastic. I mean, a lot of it is like sort of high mountain food. So there's cheeses and sort of, I'm plant-based, by the way, so I'm a vegan. But, you know, there's great cheeses and saucissons and breads. You know, the wine is amazing. You know, and the Alps is a big area. You know, it stretches essentially from the Julian Alps in Slovenia, you know, right down almost to the Mediterranean coast in France. It's a big swathe. So like the wine regions are just sort of, and the diverse, and the beer. I love beer. You know, there's all these different types of beer and there's beaches, there's lakes to swim in. It's just all there. And those that know of it will go year on year. We go every year. I mean, at the start, really? We talked about, you know, what have you been doing this year? I mean, we spent 2 weeks in Megeve.
Summer.
It's divine. You don't need to climb big mountains in the Alps. You don't need to be climbing Mont Blanc. You know, I took the children up to a little mountain hut above Solange. It was like an hour and a half, 2 hour walk there. We spent the night in the hut, you know, eating local fare, you know, potatoes, and we didn't have any cheese because we're vegan. But you know, and you can hear the cowbells outside, and then we're wild swimming in lakes, and it's beautiful. And
so funny. I literally had a conversation with my husband yesterday about how we wanted to do that next summer. So I'm going to be picking up on these tips that you've mentioned. Definitely.
Yeah, it's great. Is it a hidden gem? Well, probably not. But I think it's overlooked.
It's seen as seasonal destination and what you're saying is
a little bit. And if you go there now, when like the French holiday, if you go to the French Alps, for instance, the French holidays have come to an end, you know, it's beginning to cool down a little bit, because of heat shock this year, the leaves are already changing color, but the autumn time can be sensationally beautiful with all the autumnal colors. You know, it's cooling down, less busy, but still warm enough to go wild swimming. You can still do the Via Ferratas. You can still get up into the snow line if you want to. It's fab. It really is. So, I scratched my head and I was thinking Bhutan. I was thinking Argentina. I was thinking Terra del Fuego and all these places. But the French Alps, and you know, if you're a UK listener, you can load the car and depending where you live in the UK, you can be there in like 8, 12, 13 hours, right in the middle of the Alps.
Yeah. Oh, love it. Love it. Well, in complete contrast to that, our penultimate chapter, Kenton, is chapter 6. That is the worst traveling experience. Yeah, your travel nightmare.
It's got to be my first trip up the Karakoram Highway. This is going back to Pakistan. It's all linked, isn't it? It's all interconnected. And my first trip at the Karakoram Highway, age 19, you know, as I've already said, we flew Uzbekistan Airways to get to Islamabad. By the time we spent like 12 hours in Islamabad, we got on the train. I think I mentioned the train was 26 hours up to Islamabad. We get to Islamabad. We spent 10 hours in a bus station waiting for the public bus. The public bus then took 29 hours up the Karakoram Highway. Somewhere in that travel, young Kenton, who's never been outside of Europe really, gets his first real travel bug. And it's carnage.
The rite of passage you don't want to be getting.
So imagine we finally get on the bus. And I forget exactly what it was, but somehow the buses, the seat numbers are, the number on the back of the seat relates to the seat in front. So there's some confusion about whose seats are whose, and the locals are getting quite agitated. And then I throw up everywhere. Well, just take whichever seat you want. And to give you some idea how bad I was, when we finally got to Gilgit, which is when we got off the bus, the boys all went out for dinner. I couldn't face it. And when they came back, they found me unconscious, wrapped around the loo with, you know, poo and vomit. And I was properly not well.
And this is before your climb?
This is before we even got there.
Start for you.
I just remember being dragged off the bus. And the locals were great. This is what I mean about community. And they would take me off and they would buy me Sprite and put salt in the Sprite to try to keep me rehydrated. Because every time we stopped, I'd be sick. I would be running off to the bushes. And all I remember is about 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and we got a puncture. And they're trying to repair the puncture at the side of the Karakoram Highway, which is one of the most epic roads known to mankind. Now, and it's all hot and it's noisy. Even at 1 o'clock in the morning, it's about 25 degrees and super sticky. And they're there, they light a fire, and they're with like tire levers trying to get this tire off this bloody bus. And it's really threadbare. And I was like hallucinating by this stage, thinking, what is going on? You know, and it's that emotion thing again. I'm thinking, why don't I just go to Ibiza like any other 19-year-old? Why am I here in the middle of Christ knows where? So sleep deprived, can't keep any food down, can't keep any liquid down. Without a shadow of a doubt, my worst travel nightmare ever.
And then it turned into your all-time best I love that.
At the same time, this is what I mean. You've got to have these adversities to learn and to develop and to appreciate it, for sure. But yeah, that was a bad journey up the KKH. I've done it a number of times since, and we've always gone, we just hired a private minivan.
Very, very, very wise. Oh, Kenton, it's been so fun chatting to you today. So much fun. Our final chapter, chapter 7, is the destination that's at the top of your bucket list. Where would you love to go that you've not yet been?
again, I thought hard about this. I mean, I'm lucky. I've been to a lot of places. I think I need to explore South Africa more. I've been to the Northern Cape, and I stayed on a friend's, you know, they call it a homestead ranch thingy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love climbing. South Africa's got some amazing climbing. I've only experienced Cape Town and the Northern Cape. I'd love to travel through South Africa on a climbing trip. I mean, the Cedarburg, the Drakensberg. There's even some ice climbing, believe it or not, in South Africa if the seasons are right. And it's very, very adventurous. You know, you need a 4x4 to get around. It can be super hot. You know, it can be quite chilly. It can be super windy. So you need that local knowledge that I keep referring to. But then I've also got written in my notes, I quite like to go back to Antarctica. I've not explored the peninsula in Antarctica.
The peninsula is different. So what part have you seen thus far?
So I've been I've been to the pole. I've climbed the highest point in on the continent, which is Mount Vincent. You know, I've been to Queen's Maudland. But the peninsula is where quite a lot of people go. The peninsula is a bit that juts out north, and some of the cruise ships go down there and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's the junction between the sea and the ice, and there is this little portion where there is a heap of wildlife exists, because as soon as you get inland at all, there is knackle. There's nothing. It's just white. It's a white desert. That's all it is. I know it is, but there's nothing. Not just nothing. Whereas that peninsula holds all the wildlife, and I'd love to explore that. But then, I mean, this is the issue. I mean, I've only got those two written down here, but I'm thinking, you know, I'd love to explore the north side of Everest. Now, let's bring Everest into it. I don't particularly want to climb on the north side of Everest, but I'd love to go to explore where Mallory and Wakefield and Howard Somerville were exploring back in 1922 and 24, and those early expeditions. They all went round to Tibet from Darjeeling. I've never been to Darjeeling. You see, this is the issue with a podcast like this. As soon as you spark that, you know, I've never been to Darjeeling in India. I've always wanted to go to Darjeeling. Some people say it's not quite the place it once was. You know, the hilltop retreat for the British Raj to escape the heat and things is a bit ramshackle now. But I don't mind that. You know, to retrace the steps of those early expeditions, which I'm so in love with, you know, entering, you know, in almost into Sikkim and around into Tibet and around onto the north side, you know, through the Tibetan Plateau. I just touched upon that a little bit. That would be an amazing place to go. As well, I mean, travel is such a beautiful thing. It's such a individual thing, and what floats my boat, you know, what is my Everest is not necessarily somebody else's. But
you have to take a breath. You're like,
see now I'm not even sure it's South Africa. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's the Tibetan Plateau. But yeah, I'd love to go rock climbing more in South Africa for sure.
Wonderful. Oh, Kenton, those were your travel diaries. Thank you, Kenton Cool.
Fantastic.
Oh, huge thank you to Kenton Cool. I really enjoyed that conversation. A lot to take away from it. You can find out more about Kenton's performance initiatives at incoolcompany.com. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who is joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Threads and TikTok. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until next week, remember, there's the first 9 seasons to catch up on. That's over 100 episodes to keep you busy there. Don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app, and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks again, everyone. Take care, and I'll be back next week.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.